From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
This is what we call a tease. It's a soundbite from one of the interviews in the show. We play this tease at the beginning of the show to get your attention and to arouse your curiosity so that you'll want to listen to the show. Teases are usually shorter than this. However, there are no hard and fast rules.
On today's show, we'll look at postmodernism. We'll try to define postmodernism, or POMO. Also, we'll explore the unique tastes of millions of white people.
People always send in the site saying stuff white people like should be on the list of stuff white people like.
Got that? And we'll unveil Al Gore the Musical. It's a song by a fictional indie band called Monkey Bowl.
But you live in a postmodern world. You should know better.
But first, Salman Rushdie. He's the author of Midnight's Children. The novel earned the prestigious Best of the Booker Prize title in an online poll in honor of the Booker Prize's 40th anniversary. Rushdie's fiction is often described as postmodernist, and that term could well apply to his new novel, The Enchantress of Florence. It's a tale of two cities, featuring stories tucked inside still other stories, along the lines of Scheherazade's stories of 1001 Nights. Salman Rushdie sat down with Steve Paulson to talk about The Enchantress of Florence. Rushdie started with a reading from the novel.
At dawn, the haunting sandstone palaces of the new victory city of Akbar the Great looked as if they were made of red smoke. Most cities start giving the impression of being eternal almost as soon as they're born, but Sikri would always look like a mirage. As the sun rose to its zenith, the great bludgeon of the day's heat pounded the flagstones, deafening human ears to all sounds, making the air quiver like a frightened black buck, and weakening the border between sanity and delirium, between what was fanciful and what was real. Even the emperor succumbed to fantasy. Queens floated within his palaces like ghosts, Rajput and Turkish sultanas playing Catch Me If You Can. One of these royal personages did not really exist. She was an imaginary wife, dreamed up by Akbar in the way that lonely children dream up imaginary friends. And in spite of the presence of many living, if floating, consorts, the emperor was of the opinion that it was the real queens who were the phantoms and the non-existent beloved who was real. He gave her a name, Jodha, and no man dared gainsay him. Within the privacy of the women's quarters, within the silken corridors of her palace, her influence and power grew. Tansen wrote songs for her, and in the studio scriptorium her beauty was celebrated in portraiture and verse. Master Abdus Samad the Persian portrayed her himself, painted her from the memory of a dream without ever looking upon her face, and when the emperor saw his work, he clapped his hands at the beauty shining up from the page. "You have captured her to the life," he cried, and Abdus Samad relaxed and stopped feeling as if his head was too loosely attached to his neck. And after the visionary work by the master of the emperor's atelier had been exhibited, the whole court knew Jodha to be real, and the greatest courtiers, the Navratna or Nine Stars, all acknowledged not only her existence, but also her beauty, her wisdom, the grace of her movements, and the softness of her voice. Akbar and Jodha Bai. It was the love story of the age.
Ah, that's wonderful. Thank you. Now, you've written a novel that is grounded in history, full of real historical figures, but it also has all kinds of fantastical elements like this. This imaginary wife, sort of the great love of the Mughal of India, Akbar the Great. Why are you so compelled to mix together history with fantasy?
Well, I think in this case, because this is a world in which people believed in magic and in the magical and the fantastical as being a part of real life. You know, that's to say, this was somewhere in the novel it talks about this was a time where the real and the imaginary had not yet been sequestered into different countries with different legal systems. You know, they all blended together here. And in the case of the story of Jodha, it's just a very strange thing that this is a woman who did never exist, of whom there is no record in the very exhaustive historical records of the reign of the Emperor Akbar. And yet everybody in India believes that she did exist. I mean, if we were talking in India and you were to ask your listeners who was the queen of the Emperor Akbar the Great, everyone would say her name was Jodha, and they would tell you a story about her. They would say that she was a Hindu Rajput princess, and it was a love match, And so great was his tolerance that he never forced her to convert to Islam, but indeed would join her in her Hindu religious observances, even though he was a Muslim king.
That's fascinating. I assumed that you made her up. No. You're saying this is actually based on, well, I don't know if history is the right word.
But... I'm saying that she's a ghost in the machine. Somehow she's, and it's been helped, this legend, by two very successful Bollywood movies, which have been about the love story between the king and this particular queen. But history shows us that there was no such queen. And so it's very strange, I thought, that this very well-studied, extremely well-known emperor should have acquired through legend a queen that he never really had. Then I thought maybe even back then, everybody thought she existed, but she didn't really. And so that gave me the idea of allowing him to have this, I guess, Pygmalion-like power of inventing a woman just by the sheer force of his will.
And the way you write about her, it's not as if she's just a figment of his imagination. Somehow she's seen by other characters, too, even though she doesn't exist.
I know. She becomes a person. I mean, I think this is not unlike, is it, what writers do to their characters. You know, you make up people who don't exist, and then they... You know, if you do it right, they acquire a sort of life of their own. And so, in a way, he's performing inside the book the same function that I'm performing outside it.
Hmm. Tell me about Akbar the Great, this emperor, the great mogul of India at this time.
Well, he ruled India for a very long time. He ruled India for over 50 years, the whole second half of the 16th century. And he came to the throne, I think I'm right in saying 1551, when he was only 14 years old. His father fell down a flight of stairs and broke his neck, and he came to the throne when he was 14 and ruled until 1605, something like that. You know, so he's an exact contemporary of Queen Elizabeth I of England, and actually ruled slightly longer than her. She came to the throne a couple of years later and died a couple of years earlier, but half a century each. And he, in many ways, occupies in Indian history a very similar position to the position of Elizabeth of England, because you could argue that Elizabeth I's reign is the beginning, if you like, of England's glory. It's the beginning of England becoming a great nation. And the reign of Akbar in India does something similar to India, because under his reign, a very large part of the country, not quite all of it, but a very large part of the country was for the first time ever unified into a single kingdom. And because of his ideas of tolerance, his unwillingness to rule through brutality, his preference for ruling through inclusion and co-option, you know, he began to create something like a nation. Hmm. You know? And he was very far ahead of his time. I mean, this is a man who came from very, very bloodthirsty ancestors. This is a descendant of Genghis Khan and Tamerlane, and even his own grandfather, Babur, the first emperor, was not at all averse to an afternoon of chopping off heads.
You know? Well, and the way you write about him, he himself had proclivities in this direction.
He did. I mean,
if he didn't like someone, that person was in big trouble.
That
but on
person,
the other hand,
yeah.
He loved philosophical debate.
Yes, and his dream was peace. His whole philosophy was to create a world of what he called complete peace. And it's a very strange thing for a man with such a background. And as you say, he is an absolute ruler. He is a tyrant. If he doesn't like you, he throws you off the roof. And if that doesn't kill you, he throws you off the roof again.
Now, the other thing that you've done is you've set several stories going simultaneously here. So there's the story in the mogul's court in India. And then you also take us to Florence at roughly the same historical time. And Machiavelli appears, so the great political theorist. What's the connection here?
Well, the connection is me and my insane desire to link up two worlds that didn't know about each other. But in a way, that was the interesting thing, because they were both worlds which more or less simultaneously were having a sort of golden age. And while we know a great deal about the Western golden age of the High Renaissance and, you know, what that meant in terms of literature and painting and architecture and, you know, music and so on, it's less well known, certainly in the West, that that was also going on at a very high level in the Mughal court. And really, you could argue, I think, with real justice, that the music, the architecture, the painting, the poetry that was being created during the reign of the Emperor Akbar represents the peak of Indian art in the classical period.
Hmm. So you have all of these historical details, but then these totally fantastical details as well. And one of my favorites was there's the favorite painter of the emperor who has been commissioned to paint this incredibly beautiful woman who he's never seen, but she is legendarily beautiful. And the painter then disappears, and they're trying to figure out where he went, and then he's discovered to have somehow gone inside the painting itself. Could you read this passage?
This is a painter called Dashwant, there was such a painter in the Mughal court, and the things that are known about him I have incorporated in the book, that he was from a very humble family, and his father was a palanquin bearer, you know, like a kind of taxi driver of the 16th century. And his son was discovered, his artistic talent was discovered because he used to draw graffiti on the walls of the palace. And when he was captured doing this, the emperor, instead of punishing him, recognized that his artistic gift was so great that he put him in the imperial art studio, where he began to work on the great artistic compositions. And that's true. It also appears to be true that he was a rather depressive personality and prone to self-destructive gloominess. The rest of it I made up. He's asked to paint a portrait of the princess, the lost princess who makes her way across Europe. And as he begins to paint her story in these narrative paintings, he becomes increasingly obsessed by her, falls in love with her, and eventually does something rather unusual, which is he manages to cross the boundary between the real world and the imagined world in the wrong direction. So he becomes, vanishes into his picture. When the hidden section of the painting was revealed, the onlookers burst into cries of amazement, for there, crouching down like a little toad with a great bundle of paper scrolls under his arm, was Dashwant the great painter, Dashwant the graffiti artist, Dashwant the palanquin bearer's son and the thief of the Karakoznama, Dashwant released into the only world in which he now believed, the world of the hidden princess, whom he had created and who had then uncreated him. He had pulled off an impossible feat, which was the exact opposite of the one achieved by the emperor when he conjured up his imaginary queen. Instead of bringing a fantasy woman to life, Dashwant had turned himself into an imaginary being, driven as the emperor had been driven by the overwhelming force of love. If the borderline between the worlds could be crossed in one direction, Akbar understood, it could also be crossed in the other. A dreamer could become his dream. "Put the border back," Akbar commanded, "and let the poor fellow have some peace." When this had been done, the story of Dashwant was left to rest where it belonged, in the margins of history. At the center of the stage were the rediscovered protagonist and her new lover, the hidden princess, Lady Black Eyes, or Karakoz, and the Shah of Persia, standing face to face.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm curious about how you would describe this novel, and maybe this is the kind of thing that academics do more than fiction writers, but to sort of put a label on this, because here you have these fantastical elements that could come right out of the Arabian Nights. You also have kind of this melding of different historical periods, sort of a meeting of East and West that never really happened in real life, but you have conjured this up in your story. It's to some degree a story about storytelling. There's definitely a sense of metafiction here. Is it fair to call this a postmodern novel?
Call it anything you like.
But how do you see yourself as a writer?
Well, in this case, I think it's a novel whose quality, if you like, comes partly out of folktale, the kind of tone of voice of the fable or the folktale, and partly out of the kinds of story that people in that period like to read. You know, the most popular literature in the court of Akbar was a sequence of stories about an imaginary warrior called Hamza, who had a very remarkable life full of feats of derring do, some of which were ordinary earthly battles, but he also had a love affair with the queen of the fairies, and he possessed a pink three-eyed winged horse, and many of his battles were fought not against human beings but against ogres and dragons and assorted monsters of the deep and so on. So this was, if you like, the imaginative world of the Akbar court. Meanwhile, in Renaissance Italy, a very similar kind of imaginative world can be found, because the greatest literary success of this period was Ariosto's great narrative poem Orlando Furioso. Orlando Furioso is not set in the 16th century, it's set much earlier. It's set hundreds of years earlier, in the time of Charlemagne and knights in shining armor and damsels in distress and so on. But it's written at exactly this time and was being read, consumed avidly at this time. And this too is a world of magic, you know, of sorceresses, of demons, of possession, of ogres, of spells and enchantments and so on. So it occurred to me to write the kind of story that the people in the story would have had in their heads. I mean, only, of course, to give it a contemporary spin, because I'm not a 16th century person. You know, I'm a 21st century person. So if I look back at the past, I will inevitably give it some kind of contemporary spin. But that was the starting point. Let me tell the kind of story that they would have had in their heads.
Well, it also seems, if I can extrapolate a bit about your personal history, having grown up in India, moved to England, lived there, having been forced to live underground for a while, ending up in New York City, I mean, sort of this amalgam of different cultures, whether you're naturally drawn to tell a story like this,
yes,
you know, mixing together different historical periods, different cultures.
Yes, I myself have a pink three-eyed winged horse and have had extensive knowledge of fairies and ogres in my life. And so I'm naturally drawn to writing about them.
I see that. I can imagine who the ogres might be, but I don't know about the fairies.
That's for me to know and you to find out, I think.
Salman Rushdie is an award-winning author. His new novel is The Enchantress of Florence. Rushdie spoke with Steve Paulson. Coming up, we'll try to answer the question, what exactly is postmodernism? And we'll look at stuff white people like. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Since we're looking at postmodernism this hour, it seems only natural we should try to define exactly what postmodernism is, doesn't it? Well, that's easier said than done, since the term means different things to different people. Amy Elias is an associate professor in the English department at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. She's also the author of Sublime Desire, History and Post-1960s Fiction. Elias says there are three different kinds of postmodernism.
The first one I call epistemological postmodernism, and that's the hardest one. And that really is a transhistorical thing. That doesn't have anything to do really with 1945 or 1960. That would be the kind of postmodernism that Jean-François Lyotard is talking about as an episteme, a kind of way of understanding the self and of knowing the world. And in that version of postmodernism, what postmodernism is a reaction to and a kind of the underbelly of Enlightenment modernity. What happens in the 18th century is the creation of a thought paradigm that exists strongly right down to the present day and forms many of the assumptions of modern Western thought, how we think about the liberal human subject, human potential, or historical progress, or the importance of scientific method for discovering truth. All those things come out of the 18th century Enlightenment. And in this context, postmodernity is the way of knowing the world that can't be spoken by that epistemological paradigm. It's the thing that can't be thought within Enlightenment modernity, or the thing that can't be represented within that paradigm. So this postmodernism is a post-18th century way of knowing that chafes against Enlightenment values. It's non-Western or non-discursive or non-representational or sublime, and it undermines the values of modernity. So that's the first big kind of postmodernism. And that's usually called postmodernity rather than postmodernism.
So we have postmodernity, to be simple, for number one. What's number two?
Number two is a kind of postmodernism, and that is an ism, that I would call sociocultural. According to this kind of postmodernism, that's the post-1945 social and economic phenomenon, primarily of capitalist first world nations. And the 1945 is really important here. That's the vision we have of Levittown, Pennsylvania, the suburbs that are burgeoning after World War II. And in fact, you know, the ranch house that was built in Levittown was actually modeled on the Quonset hut for army barracks in World War II. So that post-1945 World War II moment has resonances for the rest of the century. And so this kind of postmodernism is the kind defined by Frederick Jameson or Jean Baudrillard or Adorno and Horkheimer or David Harvey and others. And it includes the diminished importance of the nation state, the increased significance of global migration, discussions about the economic importance of service and entertainment industries, global flow of capital and workers' rights, et cetera. And a big point of this conversation about postmodernism is the aestheticizing of everyday life. That big term, you know, that basically means that after World War II, our lives are increasingly dependent on technology and media representations, and the reality that we live in is turned into marketable images and sort of adult playgrounds. And so you get the discussions of life as Disneyland or infotainment industries and that sort of thing.
You know, I was just about to say that I liked this one best because it was the kind of ism that allowed you to have things to base all of your discussion on, and then you grabbed the ranch house away from me and went off with flighty intellectual discussion.
Sorry. Well,
but it does make sense. There is something there that you can sort of look at to start the discussion, which is a little harder when you get into the epistemological way of understanding self. There's a little less to grab onto. What about number three?
Well, number three would be what I call aesthetic, and that's the most problematical in many ways. That would label postmodernism as a kind of new aesthetic style that happens after the 1950s. And it would react to modernism, the aesthetic style that happened, between 1890 and 1930. And they gave us Cubism and Dada and James Joyce. You know, that postmodern art retains modernism's experimentalism, but people have claimed that it strips it of any kind of utopian politics. So people who talk about aesthetic postmodernism talk about Andy Warhol, pop artists, Cindy Sherman, Keith Haring. In architecture, they talk about Philip Johnson, James Sterling. In literature, they talk about Thomas Pynchon. And the characteristics of this are many and varied. People have written a lot about it. A main characteristic is irony and an elevation of low art forms like the comic strip or the detective story to a high art form. But this one is the most contested because people claim that modernism basically did all this and that postmodernism is just the last dregs of a high modernism that exhausted all the literary forms.
I suppose that's because you can take a William Faulkner and a Thomas Pynchon and say that they are writing in similar ways, although, my word, they're not at all alike.
Doesn't that kind of blow your mind? I mean, people keep talking about that, but it's very hard to imagine like Gertrude Stein, you know, watching The Bachelorette or, you know, emailing Ezra Pound about something. There does seem to be some sort of break between the high modernists and the postmodernists. And yet when you actually look at the literature and try to articulate what exactly the techniques were that made these 1960s and 1970s and later writers different from the earlier modernist writers, you can't really do it very easily. The techniques themselves are the same, though the subjects might be different.
It's easier when you take the graphic novel as opposed to T.S. Eliot, isn't it?
I guess, but then you had a lot of experimentation with visual forms in the modernist period, too. I'm thinking of something like Blast or the avant-garde, you know, Dada as a shaped kind of poetry sometimes. And so the visual was also very important to modernism. This is just our form of it. Yeah. I go back and forth on this one, whether we have a postmodern aesthetic, but I'm much clearer on the fact that I think we have a sociocultural postmodernism. I like number two better than number three.
I was just going to ask you which one of these settles most easily in your mind as you begin discussing the difference between now and then, which is what it comes down to, isn't it?
I guess. I think it comes down to a bunch of things. I think it comes down to a desire for anyone to want to distinguish and mark off their own time. We want to think our own time has unique properties and is special in some kind of way. And it's the job of people like me to try to find intelligent or at least cool ways to talk about that. So there's a kind of desire there. But I think, yes, I deeply believe that the world has changed and that it is our responsibility in the academy to talk about those changes.
Amy Elias is the author of Sublime Desire, History and Post-1960s Fiction. Elias is also involved with a new organization called the Association for the Study of the Arts of the Present. You can find a link to their website on our website, ttbook.org. How do you define postmodernism? And are we still in a postmodernist age? Or are we now living in a post-postmodernist age? We'd love to hear your thoughts. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. Do you belong to a food co-op? Do you brag to your friends that you don't own a television? Did you discover irony in grad school? If you answered yes to these questions, chances are you're a white person, at least according to Christian Lander's definition. Lander is the creator of the popular website Stuff White People Like. He's also the author of Stuff White People Like, the definitive guide to the unique taste of millions. Lander can trace the origin of his website and book very precisely, as he told Dan Strangchamps.
My friend actually keeps all of his logs from the Instant Messenger conversation, so we have the original one where it all came from. So we were both at work. I was working at an interactive agency in Culver City, and my friend works at EA. His name is Miles, in Vancouver. And we were talking about the TV show The Wire. We're both gigantic fans. And Miles, who's Filipino, said he didn't trust any white person who didn't watch the show because they didn't really understand what was going on in the streets. And I mean, Miles grew up in the same neighborhood as I did in Toronto, so I mean, he doesn't really know. And anyways, we started talking about what white people were doing instead of watching the show. And we came back with ideas like getting divorced, going to yoga, going to therapy, things like that. And I thought, all right, this is hilarious. I'm just going to start a blog. So I went to WordPress, which is a free blog hosting website, and just typed in stuff whitepeoplelike.wordpress.com and started writing.
What was the first entry?
Coffee.
But I mean, millions of people drink coffee, not just white people. So is there something special about the coffee white people like?
Well, it came from high school. And in high school, there were always these kids in the ninth grade who would attach one of those refillable coffee cups to their backpack and walk around the school and be really proud that they drank coffee. And you knew, you just knew they didn't like it. It was like smoking. You know, there's no way you like coffee as a 14-year-old. And it was always a white kid. And then, of course, you know, the importance of local coffee shops, independent coffee shops, fair trade coffee, organic coffee. It's not an easy process.
No, there are contradictions. For instance, Starbucks. Now, do white people like Starbucks or not like Starbucks?
This one's tough. I mean, it's a challenge because there's an appreciation that it exists so that you can get premium coffee when you need it. But there's also a hatred because they're a large multinational corporation.
So it's one of those, yes, we'd love to hate them.
Yeah, but we're still going to go.
You obviously know your demographic very well. I mean, upper middle class, public radio listening, fair trade, coffee drinking, white people. Are you one of them? One of us, I guess I should say.
29 years of research. And I'm Canadian, too, which I think pushes it to a whole different level.
That's actually something slightly better than being merely white.
Yeah. I mean, it's advanced because many of the white people in America would like to be Canadian, or at least threaten to be Canadian, which is also mentioned in the book.
Really? What is it white people admire about Canadians or Canada?
Well, universal health care, which is also something in the book. Left-wing politics, not quite in the book, but government-sponsored media in a very straightforward way. Although, of course, NPR and PBS are public radio, it's all sponsored to that rather complex Corporation for Public Broadcasting system.
So your blog wound up being a huge hit. I mean, something like 20 million hits over its lifetime, which suggests that the people that you're making fun of seem to adore you. Did that surprise you?
A little. But I think that it's sort of the same way with stand-up comedy in a lot of situations where stand-up comics are making fun of themselves and their audience, and there's a connection there because there's a truth to it. So I'm obviously making fun of myself. I mean, I'm not approaching this. I mean, though the site is written from a distance, I'm not approaching it from a distance. I'm really making fun of myself, and that's, I think, what resonates with a lot of the people who enjoy it.
And is enjoying being made fun of also somehow typical of white people?
Self-deprecating humor is in the book.
What's significant about that?
It's an important part of being white is making fun of yourself. I mean, it's an important part in the dating ritual, obviously. But I think that having a sense of humor is really, really important. And making fun of yourself is very, very important.
Do you think all your audience is white?
No, not at all. It's actually kind of funny. I get a lot of emails, and at the book signings that I've done so far, all two of them, I get people of all races who come up and absolutely love the site and love the book. And some people tell me they'd wish they had this book before they left for college. It would have saved them a lot of trouble.
But the fact that you're white means it's okay for you to do this because, you know, as we said, you're making fun of your own ethnicity. But you couldn't do stuff black people like, could you?
No, not in any sort of intelligent or funny way. The whole core of the blog and the spin-off blogs that people have started up are about tackling this issue from the inside, you know, and doing it in a non-hateful way. Like, Stuff White People Like isn't meant to be a racist site that makes people hate white people. It's done, you know, from an insider's perspective. And that's the same thing with Stuff Educated Black People Like, Stuff Asians Like, Stuff Brown People Like, Stuff Gay People Like, and so forth.
Have there been people who've criticized the blog and the book for being racist?
Oh, absolutely. I get all sorts of emails from people who think that perpetuating any stereotype is evil, and that because I'm perpetuating a white stereotype, it's racist. Other people, and this is by far my favorite, will write into the site and say, well, I'm white. I don't like sushi. I don't own a bicycle. So according to your site, I'm not white. This is offensive. And my response to that, of course, is, so you find it offensive when someone makes generalizations about your race that don't apply to you. I think there have been a few people in the past who might have suffered through this problem. Just a few.
So let's talk about some of the stuff you think white people like, besides fair trade coffee. Let's see. White people also have a thing for bottled water.
Yes. Well, it's not that simple. As the whole book will point out, with white people, nothing ever is that simple. It's bottles of water. And there's different grades that you can have applied to you as a white person. So at the very bottom is your bottled water, you know, your Arrowheads, your Fijis, things like that. But that puts you on the lower level because you're obviously creating trash. Even if you recycle the bottles, you know, you're still using all that energy to produce the bottles, to recycle the bottles. And if you're using Fiji water, you know, to fly the water in from Fiji. So the next step up from there is to use Nalgene bottles, the kind people take camping. But some science recently, or flawed science recently, said that those can possibly leach toxins. So while you're one step up on people who use bottled water, you're still not at the top. And the top is for the people who use those metal SIG water bottles or the glass ones. And those are the advanced level white people.
And what do you carry?
Me? Actually, I don't carry anything. I use water fountains.
Is that even more superior?
Absolutely. I didn't waste any money or production time or resources. I win.
So obviously concern for the environment is a crucial component of whiteness.
Well, it's not so much concern for the environment as it is telling other people about your concern for the environment that's the key component of whiteness.
And how do you see that playing out?
Throughout the book, a lot of these activities, what makes them stuff white people like isn't necessarily the stuff, but the ability to use them in the never-ending contest against other white people to find superiority.
You know, it strikes me that there's something very postmodern about your whole project. I mean, would you say that? I'm thinking partly you're, you know, it's all about deconstructing the signs and signifiers of whiteness.
Okay, so I'm going to lie. Someone actually sent in yesterday postmodernism as a suggestion for the site. And I'm actually really impressed that you used deconstruction properly. That's one of the things I wanted to put on the site was white people like using that word incorrectly. But I'm impressed you got it right. I spent some time in graduate school, so it does bother me a little bit.
Another component of whiteness.
Oh, yeah. I think that's number 67. So when it comes to postmodernism, I guess I spent too much time in graduate school to want to really debate postmodernism because I have a personal objection to it in a lot of ways. I feel like it's such a catch-all for everything. I mean, what's next? Obviously, there's the post-postmodernism debate, and there's nowhere to go from it. I think it's self-observation, I'll put it that way. And I don't know if that's necessarily postmodern, but it's been around forever. I think you could possibly call it post-wealth. And what I mean by that is it's about a generation of people who still have the drive that their parents and grandparents had to compete with their neighbors. But instead of competing over things like who has the more expensive car or the bigger house, it's about who has the more authentic experience or who has the lower carbon emission home, you know, who's LEED certified. And so the competition's still there, but it's not about wealth. It's about authenticity in the environment.
So if you were to win as a white person, you know, sort of win the Grand Slam as the ultimate most superior example of whiteness there is, what would your life look like?
Oh, it'd be tough. You would probably want to be living in San Francisco or in Silicon Valley, in a LEED certified home, driving an automobile that ran on either hydrogen or garbage, like the car from Back to the Future. That would probably be a big time victory. You would create some sort of software program or website that helped people in the third world, but also made you a lot of money that you then gave back to your own foundation.
And what about the personal details of your life? What kind of clothes do you wear? What does your furniture look like? What do you eat and drink?
You would make your own clothes. You would make your own food. You would somehow make your own water. It would be very important for you to be carbon positive. Oh, no, wait, negative, sorry. I got mixed up which way that goes. In any case, you're removing carbon from the air and somehow turning it into organic celery.
Would you have children? Pets?
Well, according to the book, you'd have to have a dog of some sort. A rescue dog, preferably. Your children, if you had children, would best if they were international adoptions. That would be a big-time victory. And of course, if you could create a child out of carbon, that'd be even better.
And what would you do for entertainment, for fun?
Oh, this would be tough. You would probably have to watch HBO series on your MacBook because you wouldn't have a television.
And what about on weekends?
On weekends, camping. You go camping somewhere.
And what would your favorite music be?
I mean, I can't even say what it is right now because your favorite music would be so far beyond what I already know that you could just make up names and I wouldn't know who the bands were. You're that far ahead. You'd like bands that hadn't been formed yet.
Thank goodness this paragon doesn't exist yet.
Yet. I'm working on it.
So are there any items that you have rejected from Stuff White People Like?
Oh, yeah. So there's an email account to the site, stuffwhitepeoplelike@gmail.com, that has over 4,000 emails sent to it. The top two things that I reject on at least a weekly basis, number one is mayonnaise. I get that almost every week. Someone says, you have to do a post on mayonnaise. You have to do a post on mayonnaise. And I won't do it for a number of reasons. Number one, mayonnaise is loved the world over in equal proportion. And number two, the movie Undercover Brother covered it so perfectly. The second one is people always send in the site saying Stuff White People Like should be on the list of Stuff White People Like, perhaps talking to your earlier question about postmodernism. And I, perhaps because of my own dislike of this sort of, well, actually, it's a dislike of the word meta in general. I just won't do it.
How self-deprecating of you.
Yes, exactly. I refuse to recognize the success of the site, which gives me humility and, you know, helps give me credibility with white people. Credibility is also in the book, actually. I think integrity, I'm sorry, is the actual name of the post.
Christian Lander is the author of Stuff White People Like, the definitive guide to the unique taste of millions. He's also the creator of the Stuff White People Like website. You can find a link to Lander's website on our website, ttbook.org. Are white people really not as unique as we think we are? Let us know what you think. Indie music is number 41 on the list of Stuff White People Like. So what better way to conclude our hour on postmodernism than with Robert Ellis Orrell, the man behind Monkey Bowl, an indie rock band that doesn't really exist. Or does it? I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Robert Ellis Orrell has been writing and singing songs for some 30 years. He's had success as a country music songwriter and singer. He still writes country music songs and works as a producer, but he's devoted a lot of his time over the last few years to a fictional indie rock band called Monkey Bowl. To the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon sat down with Robert Ellis Orrell in Nashville to talk about the postmodern music of Monkey Bowl.
This is my sound check song. This is my sound check song. I just want to see if these harmonies are drowning out the lead vocal.
Check 3, 4.
This is my sound check song.
This is my sound check song.
This is my sound check song.
To see if things go wrong.
I check things out this way so Monkey Bowl can play. Thanks for being so.
That's Robert Ellis Orrell's fictional indie rock band Monkey Bowl with Soundcheck Song. Although Monkey Bowl is not a real band, the group does perform live, as Orrell explains.
And there's this one keyboard sitting out in front of whatever band I'm opening for, and I come in with my suit and tie. I'm nervous, because I naturally am anyway, and I just tell them my name is Bob Something, I'm representing Monkey Bowl. because the band never shows up for rehearsals, and that I'm 50 years old and I've wasted the first half of my life because I always wanted to be in the record business. And the closest I've gotten to being in the record business is working the midnight to eight shift at United Record Vinyl Pressing Plant down the street. All of a sudden, all the kids who are talking to each other, or throwing darts or whatever they're doing in this club, they start to listen to me because it's like, what the heck is this guy doing? I mean, you know, and I tell them, I'm 50 years old. I'm just starting out in my career as a rock musician. So I want everybody to listen up. And I try to get them all to like be quiet. The last time I played a rock club, there's a smoking patio out in the back. And I actually, after the third song, I got up and said, excuse me. And I went out on the patio and I said, kids, come in here. I'm singing songs in here. Put your cigarettes out and come in and watch the show. And I swear all but two of them stomped their cigarettes out and just came in and said, yes, sir. And sat down and watched the show. And at the end of it all, because in reality, I've been making up pop songs for over 30 years, these kids come up and, like, you know, give me a beer and go, dude, you're pretty good. You should do this. Really, you should go for it, man. It's fun for me to have this alter ego. But on the other hand, I like the message that I have as part of my show, which is that you can't wait to follow your dreams. You got to do it now. Don't waste any time.
Monkey Bowl's new album, Ultimate, has a decidedly postmodern feel to it. It features several songs about writing songs. Was that a conscious decision on Oro's part?
It definitely was for End Title Song. Matter of fact, as we do this interview, the Nashville Film Festival is in town, and I've had a number of music supervisors come up to me and say, you know, where can I get a call? I've heard about this End Title Song. I'm like, here's the CD. I wanted to write a song that could be used basically as an all-purpose End Title Song, so that, you know, it probably wouldn't be used for a very serious drama, but if there was like a comedy or, you know, whatever, it's a funny song that basically says, this is the End Title Song, don't leave, sit down, listen to me. Listen to the song, and by the way, pick up your popcorn and all your trash and stuff that you're leaving on your seats.
Hey, where you going? Don't stand up to leave. Credits are rolling. There's so much more. Believe me, there's no hurry. Take your time and sit back down, 'cause this is the end.
The album also features a piece of haunting Kafkaesque dance rock called Trust Me, I Work for the Government.
When I was watching the Michael Moore film, the Fahrenheit 911 film, and John Ashcroft sang Soar Like an Eagle. Soar like an eagle. And I thought, well, this is true. I went back the next day and I was thinking, if I write him a hit single, maybe he'll quit being attorney general and be a singer instead, which is a job that I would prefer for him. And I got to tell you, you know, in a way it worked because I finished the song, I recorded it, and he retired as attorney general shortly thereafter. Of course, I can't claim there's any connection because I never sent him the song. But if you listen to the lyrics of that song, it's kind of creepy. Every word of that was written from the idea that it's to be sung by Attorney General John Ashcroft.
Girl, you made me fall in love with you. So what's the point of trying to hide the truth? There's no reason why you should be so nervous. I've got a good job, it's in public service. Baby, trust me. Channel, play me on your radio station, you sexy hot monopolistic corporation. Play it just for grins, 'cause I can't pay for spins, or fly you to Antigua with a couple willing twins. You say nothing in life is free, but we live in a democracy.
Clear Channel comes about from my frustration with what's happened to commercial radio in this country and the homogenization of it, the fact that you could have five, you know, stations that you listen to, and instead of each of those stations really wanting to play the music to attract you as a listener, they're all owned by the same company, so they really don't care. It's really just about the advertising. If you don't listen to the classic rock station, you're going to listen to their country station. If you don't listen to that, you're going to listen to their sports station. If you don't listen to that, you're going to listen to their right-wing talk station. So I just liked the idea of pleading with them to play my little record, which they won't.
There's a yellow sticker on the album which says that the CD features the Lindsay Lohan hit, Ultimate, but without Lindsay Lohan. Huh?
The interesting thing is this time I actually got to use the song Ultimate, which was the first Monkey Bowl song I wrote. Ultimate was written with a friend of mine as the concept that I had for it was to write the stupidest love song that anyone's ever written. I mean, the tagline is, I've been looking for someone like you all my life, and you are the ultimate you. There's this girl on the recording who keeps like saying, yeah, obviously, because as I'm trying to sing it, she's like, tell me something I don't know. What's interesting is my co-writer pitched it to Disney for the movie Freaky Friday, and they thought it was a brilliant love song. And so they asked if they could have it for the movie, and it's the end title song of Freaky Friday. It's Lindsay Lohan. It spent 2 years in the Disney Top 30, Disney Radio Top 30. But at the same time, when I was readying my first album, I couldn't use the song because they had the first license on it.
You're the kind of friend who always bends when I'm broken. Like, remember when you took my heart and put it back together again? Yeah, I used to fill my world with clueless girls, but now it's over. Let me tell you why I'm through.
Okay.
I've got someone new who's just like you. You're it, you're the ultimate. It's automatic, I'm sure of it. No lie, so don't even try to tell me that I'm not the guy. Cause I've been waiting all my life for someone just like you. But you're it, you're the ultimate you.
Okay, if you say so.
Well, I do, cause you're the on my street, 320 something Linwood Boulevard, and he doesn't know me, but I voted for him. Yeah, I punched the card. I don't know how he lives with knowing that he still lives on my street right down.
There's also a reinterpretation of an earlier Monkey Bowl song, Al Gore, which is now morphed into Al Gore the Musical, thanks to Vince Gill's musical director, John Hobbs.
He's just a mad genius. I love this guy. I ran into him outside a grocery store, and he said, oh, man, we're playing Plastic 350 all the time. It's our favorite album on the bus, and I especially love Al Gore. I just said, John, let me give you the Pro Tools files, the recording files of that song, and let you just do whatever you want with it. Just take it and run with it. And about 3 months went by, and I really didn't think much of it. And he called me up one day and said, got something to play for you. And he came over, and he had turned that song into literally a three-act musical with three distinct separate parts, full orchestration, every instrument in the book. I got goosebumps right now just thinking about the first time I heard it.
One time I lost out on a job, 'cause this kid, his father, owned the whole company. Let me tell ya, he was a jerk, and I'm still pissed that he stole that job from me. Life isn't fair, don't tell me I know it, 'cause even with the popular vote, Al Gore lives on my street.
right down the street from me. Oh, Al Gore lives on my street, right down the street from me. President Gore lives on my street, right down the street from me.
Hey man, I like your song, but you need to get over all that stuff. Hey, this is a great neighborhood.
That's Monkey Bowl with Al Gore the Musical from the new album Ultimate. Robert Ellis Orrell, alias Bob Something, is the leader of Monkey Bowl. He spoke with, to the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon.
Well, we've just heard a really, 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 really long clip from public radio, from our show, as a matter of fact, Public Radio International's To the Best of Our Knowledge. Public radio is another thing white people like, right?
Oh, absolutely. In order to keep public radio surviving, they, you know, obviously rely on donations and fund drives. So they have to make sure that their programming then appeals to that same group. So while white people will talk about the lack of diverse voices in the for-profit media, there's sort of an interesting contradiction about the lack of voices that comes out of the public radio arena as well, and the need to keep their listeners happy.
Who would you say is the whitest person in public radio?
Ira Glass is pretty much the king at this point, but if all the listeners could form together into some sort of Leviathan, that would be the answer.
Christian Lander is the author of Stuff White People Like, The Unique Taste of Millions. He spoke with N. Strange Champs. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 83A, Post-Postmodernism. Are we there yet? If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, N. Strange Champs, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickard. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.